colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups.
And through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation.
To promote the study of political and economic problems.
And of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.
Hi, this is Shepard Ferry, and you're listening to People Powered Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. I'm about to have a nervous
breakdown. Well, good afternoon, friends. I'm Maria Hall, and this is the Lawyers Guild Show. My wonderful co-host and friend Jim Lafferty is on the road to visit family, but he'll be back with us next week. And speaking of being on the road, I know today is one of the heaviest traffic days of the year, so if you're stuck in your car right now, thank you for tuning in. I'm going to do my best to make your drive a little more interesting. We've got a great show today. In our first half hour, media critic Norman Solomon will be talking about his new book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell. It's a great read. It's actually really fun, and I did it in one sitting. And Norman will even tell you how to get a free copy. And then in our second segment, I'll be joined by members of the Let Cuba Play Committee. They'll talk about how Trump's immigration policies are preventing talented Cuban athletes from competing in the 2028 Summer Olympic Games. But they haven't given up, and they'll share what listeners can do to help the athletes participate. So stay tuned for that. And in the meantime, Ozzy, let's roll my interview with Norman. In 2016, a man famous for humiliating people on television with the catchphrase, "You're fired," was elected president of the United States. Many were surprised, chief among them his opponent, Hillary Clinton. But others, like our guest this segment, saw it coming and believes the Democratic Party could have done so much to avoid it. Today, in the midst of Trump presidency number two, the country is as polarized as ever. How did we get here, and where are we headed? Is there a way to avoid the U.S. slipping into a country where only the wealthiest enjoy power, resources, liberty, and justice? Our guest this segment will help us think through those questions. He is Norman Solomon, author of the new book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. Norman is the National Director of Roots Action and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He is the author of more than a dozen books, including War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Solomon has written about politics for many publications, including The Hill, The Nation, The Guardian, Common Dreams, the LA Times, and Salon. Norman Solomon, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thanks so much, Maria.
Sure. Well, you chose a unique format for your book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell. Talk about that form. It was really fun, by the way. I enjoyed reading it. And how that form advances your overall theme and purpose.
There are a couple elements that come to mind. One is that often we're told that we didn't know at the time what was going to happen, what the forces were that were moving history in a certain direction. And the vast majority of this book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, was written in real time between 2016 and just a few weeks ago. And so I think, as was the case with many progressives and others, I realized that going down the neoliberal path, going down the warmonger path, as Hillary Clinton did, as Joe Biden did, and then continuing that attitude, Kamala Harris, was a disaster, not only morally, but also politically. And so one of the main themes of The Blue Road to Trump Hell is that road was paved by an elite so-called leadership of the Democratic Party that had its collective fingers in its ears, didn't want to listen to the base, didn't want to listen to those who would turn out in large numbers for the Democratic Party ticket if they had something really to stand for and to fight for.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book begins in January 2016. That was when you wrote the first entry in real time, when Barack Obama was still president. But you argue later and in the introduction that the stage was set for a Trump presidency actually long before that. Give us a sense of history. What led up to that moment when Trump was first elected?
Well, unfortunately, in a gradual way, the National Democratic Party abandoned the working class. It began really in the 1980s and then much more in the 1990s with Bill Clinton's presidency, the so-called welfare reform, which was an attack on low-income women and children, the 1996 Telecommunications Reform Act, where Clinton and Gore pushed it with the Republican Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. And on from there, it was a very corporate-friendly last few years of the 20th century in the Democratic Party. And that led to, unfortunately, while not as corporate friendly as the Republican Party, the first Democratic administration of this century really continued that sort of a downward spiral, really embracing Wall Street. And so an example was all of the toxic mortgages and the exploitive arrangements that came finally to drag down so many millions and millions of middle-class people, low-income people who had found a way to buy a house. And in 2008, it's ironic that Barack Obama was elected president the first time because of this tragic ripoff of working people, of low and middle-income people. And he turned around in 2009 and gave away the store to the banks. And so he bailed out the banks and he let underwater households, millions of them, sink. And so the idea that Barack Obama was a friend of the working class was mostly a myth. And that had really severe political consequences because, sure, just like Bill Clinton, Barack Obama got reelected, but he did great damage to the party at the grassroots. And it's really notable, as I mentioned in the book, that during the 8 years of the Barack Obama administration, Democrats lost about 1,000 seats in state legislatures. And we're seeing now the consequences because those people then had a foothold. They kept the foothold in the state legislatures and they gerrymandered like hell after the 2020 census. And we're struggling with that right now. Another aspect is that the Obama administration gave away the largest amount of wealth from low and middle income people to the rich in a century. The transfer of wealth that the Democratic administration presided over is just mind-boggling. So here we had then not only Hillary Clinton, but then the Biden-Harris administration, Harris trying to defeat Donald Trump last year. And they're sort of clueless. They think that their base, the Democratic Party base, is really still going to be pleased with them. And they're shocked when they find out, as happened last year, for the first time, that most working people, the base of the Democratic Party, went with this phony, pseudo-populist, right-wing bigot, Donald Trump.
Well, can you describe the audience you had in mind when putting together the book? Were you writing to the Democratic Party or was it broader than that?
I was really writing to everybody who's concerned about the autocracy that we now live under. You know, the subtitle of The Blue Road to Trump Hell is How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. And certainly as we speak here near the end of 2025, the autocracy is well upon us. Basically, the dictatorship of the richitariat, you might say, the executive branch, legislative branch, a lot of, including most of the Supreme Court, really dictating how the vestiges of democracy in this country are going to be further attacked. And, you know, I'm really, one of the many reasons I'm glad to be speaking on that National Lawyers Guild show is that for many, many decades, the Lawyers Guild has defended people who are protesting against the abuse of power. And certainly the abuse of power is happening more than ever in this country. In terms of the audience of this book, you know, Maria, I have written at this point, I guess it's 14 books. And this is the first time that I've had an opportunity to have a book published. And from the very start, it's free. It's free online at, and the website is blueroad.info. And anybody who can look at a PDF can read the entire book now, even though and as it is a new book. And it's also formatted not only as a PDF, but also as an ebook, EPUB. So to me, that's exciting because, yes, it's in print and people can buy it on print for $20, but they can read it for free and they can share it with friends. And I think it does go back to this idea that when information and analysis is commodified and put out for sale, that's part of the assault that we've been living under ever since the right wing, including more and more Democratic so-called leader elites, are trying to dismantle the vestiges of the New Deal and the Great Society. So to sort of sum up, there's an attitude, and it is really widespread, not only among the Elon Musks, who, for instance, he said, we should privatize everything we possibly can. Well, that's a totally obviously nutty thing. But there are a lot of neoliberals and others in both parties, including the Democratic Party, who believe we should keep privatizing. And what that is saying essentially is that public space is wasted space, and we should privatize as much as possible for profit. So in my own little way, I'm saying people want to read the Blue Road to Trump Hell, you just go to blueroad.info. You don't have to pay a penny.
Yeah, and I will add, like I said, I ended up losing track of time, and I read it all in one sitting. It took me a couple hours, but
That's good to hear.
Yeah,
Maria, you're one of the first people to ever read that book. And I should add that there are terrific cartoons in it.
Yes.
Almost a dozen by Matt Worker. And he has a great history. You know, he had been doing cartoons for the progressive magazine Z many decades ago. He actually, for the Common Courage Press book, did many covers, including several books that I wrote with my fellow media critic, Jeff Cohen. And he's just this fantastic political cartoonist. And lo and behold, in 2012, he won the Pulitzer Prize, probably one of the only leftists in history to win that particular prize, which is mostly an establishment operation.
Wow. And I know you and I share the love for political satire and comedy as well. So it is, it's fun. It's easy to read. The print is large on the PDF. Yeah. So I like that. But it does, it'll take you back. So yes, please, I hope everyone will look at it. So Bernie Sanders, another topic that I love. So yeah. Bernie Sanders was a candidate for president both in 2016 and 2020. And you describe in the book how the corporate media shifted in their coverage of him as he gained in popularity. Tell us about that and how it's relevant to what we're experiencing today.
There was pretty much of a explicit and implicit teaming up between corporate media and the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016. The Bernie Sanders campaign was up against the team up of corporate media and Joe Biden in 2020. And there was all sorts of nonsense. You know, by the beginning of the second round in 2019, there was a media spin that, oh, well, Bernie Sanders has become irrelevant because some of his program has been adopted by other candidates. And yet the Medicare for All, Johnny-come-latelys, the Jane-come-latelys, who said, oh, yeah, we support Medicare for All, they backed away right away. People like Pete Buttigieg, it was just a scam. They weren't real about it because they didn't have a history. And Bernie Sanders, for decade after decade, has been saying basically the same thing. And I talk in the book about how corporate media mock him because, gee, isn't that boring? He talks about how the working class is being exploited. Ho-hum. Well, of course, that's boring to people who identify with the elite interests of the country and corporate power. And so this is a prophetic message that Bernie has brought forward again and again. And when, and I quote him in the book in a couple of instances where he pointed out that the Democratic Party was headed for disaster because it was alienating. It wasn't fighting for working class people. There's one quote I put in there right after the last disastrous presidential election, when he said, right after the polls closed last November, it's not surprising that the working class would desert the Democratic Party, since the Democratic Party has deserted the working class. Before that, he also made the comment that I quote as well, where he said, there's no doubt there are some Democratic leaders, they don't mind being on the Titanic as long as they have first class seats. And I think that's very true. I note that when Bernie was running very strong, and it looked like he might win the Democratic Party nomination for president, there was a lot of talk among supposed Democrats on Capitol Hill, but especially in Wall Street, on Wall Street and in Silicon Valley, people who were giving money time after time to Democratic Party leaders and rolling out really, you know, very expensive thousands and thousands of dollars a plate fundraisers for Democratic candidates. And some of those same folks, the really powerful people on Wall Street, when Bernie was looking strong, they were publicly saying, well, I don't know if Sanders is the nominee. I might have to go with Trump.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, your book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, touches on some warning signs that Democratic Party leaders could have heeded but chose not to. What were some of those signs, and what can we learn from those failures going forward?
Yeah, one of the stunning signs was not only did polling in 2022 and throughout 2023 and into 2024 make very clear that the large majority of Democrats in this country, self-identified Democrats, were clear they did not want Joe Biden to run for re-election. And a stunning statistic was that 94% of Democrats under the age of 30 said they didn't want Biden to run for re-election. And so you had the party establishment just completely ignoring what their supposed constituents really want. And one thing I point out in the book is that if you look at the figures, okay, maybe 60 to 70% of Democratic Party voters around the country were outspoken. If they were asked, they were very clear: we don't want Biden to run for re-election. And you can go through 2023 and into 2024, and the percentage of Democrats in Congress willing to say that Biden shouldn't run for re-election was about 1%. So that really dramatizes the extent to which the elite, corporate-oriented Democratic Party leadership is willing and able and oriented to actually represent the people that they claim to represent. And I should say this isn't hindsight, and this gets back to how I mentioned that the vast majority of this book was written in real time. Nothing changed to revise because of what had happened subsequently. And it goes to I make no claim to be a genius. There were people on KPFK, other Pacifica stations, writing on sites like Common Dreams or Truth Out or Truth Dig. And throughout 2022, 23, into the disastrous debate time in the middle of 2024, progressives were saying, for two reasons, Biden shouldn't run for re-election. One, he would be a weak candidate against the Republican. And two, his program sucks in a lot of ways. And especially after the war on people in Gaza, that Biden was arming and aiding genocide. And the base of the party, the polls were very clear. Most Democrats wanted to stop the weapons flow from the United States to Israel because Israel was committing genocide. And yet we had not only Biden, but then when Harris jumped in, it was just pathetic and outrageous. Morally, it was horrible. And then it was political malpractice. You know, there was that infamous time, when she was on The View on ABC. So we have Kamala Harris. She's in the stretch drive of her campaign against Trump last year. And she's asked, is there anything you would do differently than President Biden? And Kamala Harris said, nothing comes to mind. And this is sort of a repetition compulsion disorder, the conformity, the fear of stepping away from the corporate and militaristic power. And in the book, I compare it to, unfortunately, very similar to Hubert Humphrey in 1968, where he was so frightened when LBJ stepped down to run for re-election. Humphrey was so frightened of making Johnson mad at him that he couldn't distance himself publicly away from the Johnson policy making war on Vietnam. And when Humphrey finally began to distance himself, not soon enough and not enough, his polls really rose, and he almost defeated Nixon in November of 1968. And pathetically and disgustingly, Harris didn't even distance herself at all from the war policies, the genocide policies of President Biden.
Yeah. Oh, if you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. I am co-host Maria Hall, and my guest is media critic Norman Solomon, author of a new book called The Blue Road to Trump Hell, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. Well, in the last chapter of your book, it's the last chapter is called All of the Future at Stake. So in broad strokes, what is your assessment of where we are in politics in the U.S. right now?
Oh, I'm going to quote Antonio Gramsci, who I discovered was not the originator of this statement, but popularized it. Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. That's where we are, because if we look at the conditions right now, the control of media more and more by the U.S. oligarchs, the moves against democracy that are being implemented more and more by Republicans, there's not a lot of great reasons for optimism. But there are a lot of reasons, not only for optimism of the will, but also concretely what has been happening. We have just had in the last few weeks the election of Democratic Socialists as mayor, not only in New York City, but also in Seattle. And I think there are going to be a lot more efforts electorally for people to seize power. And I think this is so important. There tends to be a juxtaposition between electoral work and grassroots community organizing. We need both. It's like walking on two legs. Electoral work is crucial. Building social movements is crucial. The electoral work should be a subset of the social movements, but we cannot get the changes we want until and unless we get these right-wing thugs out of power and government.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the recurring themes in The Blue Road to Trump Hell is not to give in to autocracy, not to give up, but to fight. So what should people of conscience be fighting for rather than just fighting against? And what advice can you give to people who feel powerless or afraid right now?
Well, it's understandable to feel powerless and afraid. We have these opportunities to fight back, and we have to. It's essential. You look at history, everything we have to be proud of in this country is because people fought from the grassroots. They organized. They never took no for an answer from the elites. They fought City Hall. They fought the militarists and so forth. And I think that now we do have this opportunity because if you look, for instance, at polling, the progressive agenda is a majority agenda. Healthcare, enhanced Medicare for all, free public college, subsidized, hopefully free childcare, elder care. There are so many ways in which there is popular support for a progressive agenda. Where it hits a wall is really, I think, two main ways. The corporate media, and so we need to support KPFK, we need to support Pacifica, other independent radio outlets, websites, efforts to use the internet, to use print, art, dance, movies, music, every which way. This is going to take so many efforts from so many ways for us to push against this autocracy and this nascent dictatorship. So we do have the program. We can organize. We're taught by media not to organize, and we need to thumb our nose at that kind of messaging and say, hell no, we're going to organize and we're going to make change that is absolutely essential.
Mm-hmm. And one of the highlights of your book, in my mind, was that you do go back and you look at wisdom from past eras, and you have some amazing quotes. Can you tell listeners, what are some of your favorite quotes that you have in the book?
Well, I have to admit that a lot of them are from Bernie Sanders, and because he has spanned so many decades, and he's still going, the Energizer Bernie Sanders. I think FDR personified, where he said to the oligarchs of that day, he said, they hate me and I welcome their hatred. Well, and we've had leadership in the Democratic Party where it's been the opposite. That's essentially what Bill Clinton and Barack Obama said. It's essentially what Biden and Harris said. They said the oligarchs, the rich, the billionaires, there's nothing wrong with them. I want them to like me. And so these kind of messages from progressive leaders in past decades and really centuries, I think, are inspiring. You know, we're carrying a torch, and often it's a downpour of rain on the torch, but it's been around for a long time. We're updating it all the time. And that's why the right wing is so freaked out about the incoming mayoral power in Seattle and New York City. And we gotta fight for power. One other aspect, and of course I do, and this also helps to answer your question. I quote in the book more than once, Martin Luther King Jr. He denounced the madness of militarism. Those are his words. And he also said something that as well is not nearly as well known as I have a dream. You know, Obama turned it into I have a drone. But of course, when Martin Luther King Jr. said I have a dream, it was transcendent. It turned out he evolved into being a socialist. And one of the things that King said, and this is not a very well-known quote, is that love without power is pathetic and anemic, and power without love is ruthless. And so the progressive agenda is really all about merging power and love, because just one or the other ain't going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, before I get to the last question, because we are running out of time, I did also want to ask you, what's next for Norman Solomon?
I'm part of the RootsAction.org team, and I love working with a dozen folks who are every day working on not only internet communication, but grassroots organizing. So I invite everybody to sign up for our action alerts. You can go to RootsAction.org. That's R-O-O-T-S action.org. And also, I'm going to be talking in the next year or two, really, and trying to help organize around this question of transforming the Democratic Party, because when we face it next year and in 2028, the only way to oust these criminals from the White House and Congress is going to be to put up an effective and winning electoral strategy. And I would just remind people, Zoran Mandani, he ran as a Democrat, and we see the results. And if Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib had not run as Democrats, they wouldn't be in Congress. So let's keep going. Let's organize. Let's seize power, because that's essential.
Yes. And educate yourself by reading this book. So let us know that. Where can listeners learn more about you and get a copy of The Blue Road to Trump Hell, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy?
Well, you can read the book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, by going to this website, blueroad.info. That's blueroad.info. And you have your choice there. A free PDF, a free ebook, or if you want to, you can purchase the book as well.
Wonderful. So, Norman Solomon, thank you so much for joining us again on the Lawyers Guild Show. We always love your insights.
Thanks so much, Maria, and many thanks, as always, to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you. We'll have you back soon.
Thanks.
All right. Well, I am Maria Hall, co-host of the Lawyers Guild Show. That was Norman Solomon. He is an author, media critic, founder of many organizations, just a really nice human being as well. So hopefully if you're stuck in your car traveling today on this busiest traffic day of the year, I hope you enjoyed that. And I do ask that you stay with us. We are going to be taking a very short station ID break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about the 2028 Olympics and how certain people, some very superstar athletes, are being excluded from those games and what you can do to help. So stay right with us. We will be back in a moment.
KPFK's end-of-year drive starts on Giving Tuesday, December 2nd. Help us secure 500 new and sustaining members. Be ready to sign up for as little as $5 a month and power the voices of independent and free speech radio. Can KPFK count on you? Help us hit 500 members between now and the end of the year by calling 818-985-5735, option 2, or visit kpfk.org/donate for further information.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
Get up, stand up.
All right, well, as promised, we're back. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall. My co-host, Jim Lafferty, is on the road today visiting family, but he'll be back next week. And in the meantime, I've got another great set of guests here today, so stay tuned. You know, the Summer Olympics are coming to Los Angeles in 2028, and although the Games are supposed to be apolitical, Trump is already using them to exact political leverage. He's threatened to move the Games from LA because he doesn't trust the Democratic leaders, and he created an Olympics task force to regulate visas and coordinate security, and appointed himself the lead of it. And more pertinent to our topic today, his administration is preventing a group of superstar athletes from competing in the 2028 Games simply because they are from Cuba. Our guests this segment have launched a new campaign called Let Cuba Play, a global effort to help Cuban athletes secure U.S. visas so they can compete in the 2028 Summer Games. Joining me are Hakeem Jihad, an organizer with the Jacksonville, Florida Hands Off Cuba Committee, Destiny Rivera, an organizer with Los Angeles Hands Off Cuba, and Mark Friedman, co-founder of the LA Hands Off Cuba Committee and organizer of labor and youth activists' delegations to Cuba. Hakeem, Destiny, and Mark, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Hi, thank you for having us. It's an honor to be here, and shout out to all the listeners who are here today. And thank you for having us again.
Yes, thank you for having us, Maria.
My pleasure. Hi, Mark.
Hi, and thank you again. Very important show, and we've got a lot to report on and to ask the help of people in Los Angeles and other Pacifica radio station listeners.
Wonderful. Well, why don't we start with Hakeem? Can you remind us what is the fundamental mission and purpose of the Olympic Games and who's in charge of them?
Well, all of the Olympic Games, whether they be summer or winter, are organized by an International Olympic Committee, which has 107 members. These members come from all different countries, and many of them are past Olympic medalists, some are business people, and others are politicians. Four of them are from the United States. The president, Christy Coventry, the former Olympic swimmer from Zimbabwe, one is from Cuba. Many countries have more than one, and it is European dominated, which means the majority of them come from the European countries. Tiny European countries have one, while South Africa doesn't have any. Even the U.S. colony of Puerto Rico has one. They have a mission and purpose in organizing the Games.
Well, Destiny, Fidel Castro was famous for his love of sports, and he used it to promote Cuban national pride. Tell us about Cuba's history participating in the Olympics in the past. And I do understand they've won a few medals.
Yeah, Fidel and the entire leadership of the Cuban Revolution, whether that be trade unions, the women's organizations, farmers, youth, and even like campus organizations, have always viewed sports in Cuba as an important part of the revolution. A part of them establishing themselves as a nation, finding grounding, because the Olympics is a respected event across the world where nations come together and they're able to support and at least even advocate. It's a very emotional experience for many countries to see themselves and like their players, people from their country, go and compete. It's a way to give young people an opportunity to express themselves, both on an individual or a team or collective level. I mean, the collectivity, especially in a revolution, is so vital to maintaining hope and faith and unity. And I mean, what's better than, you know, you being at home, like if you were in the stands supporting and rooting, because you're rooting for your own self-determination as you root for these athletes. And how, like Hakeem has shared, like Cuba has built stadiums and soccer fields and basketball and tennis courts throughout the nation or to develop these athletes. So that form of development is also a way of nurturing. It's a way of really building a space for their own people to thrive. And we see that in other countries as well. So this is, Cuba's no different than any other country that wants to support the dreams or the initiatives of their people by basically funneling resources to these areas. And so our delegation in Cuba had visited one of these sports complexes connected to the University of Havana. And we've met leaders of the Instituto Nacional de Deportes, Educación Física y Recreación to discuss and propose what this campaign means for Cuban athletes and why is it so important for the U.S. to grant visas to these athletes. And so that understanding the testimonies and the storytelling also brings us a little bit deeper into why is it important to Cuba and to its people. So that's where we're at. Like it's the revolution may have happened 70 years ago, 70 plus years ago, but it is a part of their culture to maintain their self-determination, their unity. And also the revolution was a time where their pride and their love for their country was contested and challenged. It is not something that just existed under Fidel's, time and power, but rather it is a continued part of the lives of Cubans. And it may just be for some people, it's through the participation in the Olympics and their pride through sports of how they show up as Cuban people. Yeah,
and I understand they've won a number of medals. It isn't as if they just want to be tagging along. They are real competitors.
Yeah, since the revolution in 1960, Cuba has won a total of 244 Olympic medals. This includes 86 gold, 70 silver, and 88 bronze. So this count definitely reflects the medals that were won in the Summer Olympics through the 2024 Paris Games. And Cuba has been ranked the second out of all American countries in terms of Summer Olympic gold medals, only behind the U.S., a country with unlimited wealth devoted to sports and a population 35 times its size. I just think that's is an opportunity to definitely recognize Cuba for its excellence and where, and not just in sports, but in various areas, whether that be through medicine, whether that be through education, as a dancer, whether that be dance, you see these athletes and these dancers and these doctors excel in what they practice, despite being reduced to very minimal resources. And that's where I've been in awe and also humbled in many ways to just admire the excellence, the perseverance and resilience of the Cuban people. And their most successful sport has been boxing. And they won 235 Olympic medals. And then they came second in baseball. And then just as individual athletics as well.
Wow. Well, Hakeem, currently is Cuba recognized by the International Olympic Committee?
Yes, absolutely. Cuba has actually participated in the Olympics as well as the Paralympics for decades now, joining in and competing in the qualifying games in countries around the world, including the U.S.
Wow. Well, and Destiny, does Cuba have athletes right now who are ready and willing to compete in 2028? And if so, tell us about them. Give us a little clue about who these people are.
Recently, Belly of the Beast, which is an independent journal in Cuba, has made a video about a women's volleyball group, and the fact that their visas were recently denied in order for them to participate in pre-qualifying events. So if you would like to visit Belly of the Beast, you get to learn a little bit more about these athletes and their stories about being denied these visas, not allowing them to participate in any pre-qualifying events. And that's where I would say you get to know more the faces. First of all, put a face to these players who are working to qualify for these. And there are other athletes as well who have already been, trying to work towards being a part of these Olympics in 2028. And there are hundreds of Cuban athletes and teams in volleyball, baseball, soccer, others, more than a dozen sports, as well as individual competitions that are not team-based, that have been training for years to participate in the Olympics. I think one of the most difficult, because of censorship and because Cuban media is so restricted, especially for us in the United States, there are a lot of athletes who don't get their stories heard. There are athletes and teams that are working, and then Belly of the Beast is one of the journals that are working to capture their stories so that we can put a face to these athletes that are working really hard to be acknowledged and to also be given a chance to participate. I think it's very devastating for someone to be turned away for something that is a passion. Perhaps their livelihood is based on this sport and practice.
Wow. And I do want to get into a little bit later about the suppression of media and some of the other sanctions that have been Cubans have been dealing with. But Hakeem, I wanted to ask you if you could walk us through what exactly is the U.S. government doing that's preventing Cuban athletes from competing in 2028?
Absolutely. It is quite bad. Entire delegations have been unable to attend competitions or even something as simple as a technical meeting that are part of the path to the summer event that will take place in Los Angeles. Like Destiny was saying, the Cuban national women's volleyball team was denied the right to travel to the pre-Olympic qualifying tournament in Puerto Rico. The U.S. also denied visas to the coaches of the Cuban youth softball team due to immigration restrictions imposed by Trump, who justified the denial with the argument about risk to national security and categorized Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism. So the team that was made up of 10 to 12-year-olds could not participate. The Cuban men's basketball team was barred from competing in a FIBA AmeriCup qualifier, also in Puerto Rico. Several Cuban Olympic officials were denied visas to attend meetings in Miami and Puerto Rico, which, of course, were very critical. So this is why the international campaign Let Them Play was born, to defend the right of Cuban athletes to compete, grow, and represent their country on equal terms. When a country denies an athlete the fundamental right to compete, it not only disrupts the sporting calendar, it also harms careers, individual efforts, collective dreams, and the possibility of representing an entire nation with dignity. So that's why this new campaign is so important. Let Them Play is not just a slogan, it's a fundamental call for justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, Destiny, what about on the more international stage as well? Does this action by the U.S. violate any Olympic Committee rules or policies?
Yeah, that is a question that our delegation is currently researching and understanding the policies that have been put in place. But the fact that the IOC has been pressured by Washington already in denying visas to 100 Cuban athletes and teams to enter the U.S. for qualifying matches is an indicator that there are violations taking place here. It is agreed upon the rules of the International Olympic Committee, which there are a couple, and I have them here. It takes a strong public stance against denying visas to athletes based on discrimination, including nationality. The IOC views these actions as a violation of the Olympic Charter, which promotes the right of all eligible athletes to compete without political interference. I'm rather new to organizing for Los Angeles Hands Off Cuba, it is my most basic understanding and the foundation of my understanding is that what is happening between the U.S. and the barricade and the blockade on Cuba is a political a relationship. It is a political act. So the reason why they're not being allowed is related to politics, and that violates. So this idea of national security, the fact that the president themselves is barring the visas from being allowed to these Cuban athletes is therefore violating their protections as athletes in order to participate, that would allow them to participate in the Olympic Games. There's supposed to be neutrality and non-discrimination. That has, based on what is happening, has not been evident. There is discrimination being happened. There is no neutrality towards the Cuban athletes. And so, therefore, the Olympic Charter is supposed to forbid those forms of discriminatory practices or behaviors. And that is not happening. And so that is why it is important for us to put pressure on Washington, but especially more than Washington is to put pressure on the IOC to uphold their charter and their policies that have been put in place. As much as we would love to go to the White House and pressure them, it is not necessarily their responsibility solely. Rather, who is hosting these events, who are in charge of the wellness of the athletes, who are in charge of the wellness of folks attending this event, working this event, and making these negotiations, folks who are supposed to create travel and who are supposed to put on this whole event, they're the ones who are supposed to be responsible for something like this that is happening.
Well, Hakeem, I wanted to give you a little more space to talk about the Let Cuba Play campaign. Is there a chance still? I have a suspicion that you're not giving up quite yet. is there still a chance that Cuban athletes can still participate in the 2028 Olympic Games here in Los Angeles? And if so, what needs to happen? What is the call to action here?
Absolutely. And no, we are far from giving up. Like Destiny was saying, though, you know, our primary objective is to convince enough members of the IOC to reject Washington's pressure and abide by their own rules. So there's another side of this campaign, and that is our efforts to solicit sports writers and athletes from all over the world to add their names to the list of endorsers who are in support of Cuban athletes playing. We already have a list of hundreds of athletes who are set to compete in the Summer Olympics, and that's who we will go after in their support of a democratic Olympics. In just a week's time leading up to our first international call, we have achieved some pretty impressive endorsements, some of which from Bita Amani, a public health professor and social epidemiologist, Bidia Benjamin from Code Pink, Bob Schwartz from Global Health Partners, just to name a few. So we need listeners of this program to join in and help us win as well.
So why don't you let it, we'll come back to it at the end as well, but Destiny, why don't you let us know quickly how listeners can get involved with Let Cuba Play?
Yeah, so we would recommend visiting our website and learning more about Hands Off Cuba Committee, not just the one that are working in Los Angeles, but there are various chapters across the United States that you can get involved in. While it's not in every state, we are on both coasts. And getting to learn about what is the Let Us Play campaign about. So if you visit our website, or you can email us at letusplay@gmail.com, we would be able to provide you with essential information, such as articles detailing this specific topic. So you may learn more of like the holistic view of what the campaign is trying to achieve. But our website also has ways in which you can connect with us. You can learn about what we're advocating for. The LA Committee has three demands, and just to share that, and what we do is that we want to end the trade and travel sanctions. We want to end the blockade, as well as U.S. out of Guantanamo Bay, and remove Cuba from Washington's list of alleged suspect terrorist nations, the state-sponsored list for terrorism. Those are all related to this campaign for let the Cuban players play, and as well as getting them their visas. Because of these sanctions, because of them being put on a state-sponsored list for terrorism, that is why it is much easier, and that's why it's not out of character for the United States to deny them their visas. So inevitably, this is all connected. The Cuba solidarity work that we do is inevitably connected, which is why it is important for us to show up for Cuban athletes, because we are showing up for Cuban people as a whole. That would be the best way. We also have where you can also sign your own endorsement as an individual or as an organization via our website. But if you email us at letcubaplay@gmail.com, we'll be able to send you those links as well as a volunteer sheet if you are interested in getting involved with us.
Wonderful. Well, if listeners are just tuning in, I'm Maria Hall, co-host of the Lawyers Guild Show. My co-host Jim Lafferty is on vacation, but he'll be back next week. I'm speaking right now with members of the Let Cuba Play Committee. Hakeem Jihad and Destiny Rivera and Mark Friedman is also here to chime in. He's been quiet so far, but I think on this next question, he might be able to give us some insight. In the last, we have about 7 minutes or so. I really want to get an update. I know it's a big subject. We could have a show on it all by itself. But on what is the update right now, the status of U.S.-Cuban relations overall? I know there's been a lot of flux in the past, especially past 10 years, but right now with Trump in charge. What is the latest? What should listeners know about U.S.-Cuban relations overall? Mark, why don't you handle this one?
Thank you.
And then anyone else can chime in as well.
And I think I have very little to add to the tremendous effort by Destiny and Hakeem to explain this campaign. And this campaign is way beyond any other international campaign that Cuba solidarity committees around the world have ever tried to do. So in that sense, it's a massive collaborative efforts with Cuba support committees in Europe, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. The denial of the visas not only violates the right of Cuban athletes, but also the right of people living in the U.S. and around the world to participate in this international program to enjoy the excellence they bring to the games. The government in the United States continues to tighten the noose on the people of Cuba, denying them food, energy resources, and basic resources to continue with their tremendous pharmaceutical programs. This has been intensified under the Trump regime with the shutting down of more than 300 Western Union offices in Cuba, where Cubans and others were able to send remittances to their families, the elimination of any cruise ships being able to dock in Cuba, and a whole range of others, 243 of them to be exact. But Cuba supporters, people who support the sovereignty of Cuba, are intensifying this campaign around the visas because we think that this is a weak point of the denial of visas, not only to athletes, but to academics, scientists, artists, musicians from Cuba, all of whom have been denied visas this year. The U.S. government has attacked the international medical teams and the thousands of doctors and nurses that have gone to dozens and dozens of countries to help with medical aid, with hurricane relief. Rubio has made it a campaign of traveling to Caribbean nations to try and pressure them not to vote on the UN resolution to end the blockade. A few of them caved under pressure of tariffs, and the U.S. can virtually, you know, break any country in the world through these threats. But still, the vote was 179 against the blockade and a handful for it, including the U.S. and Israel. The sanctions against Cuba are more than against any other country in the world. And many people in the U.S. don't realize this because there is so little media coverage of it. And what media coverage is always from the right wing or what Trump and Rubio and those who are trying to crush Cuba and have been trying to crush Cuba ever since year one of the revolution have been trying to do. So we believe that the Trump-Rubio regime will not stop their assault on Cuba. And so we must continue our efforts to secure resolutions and actions. Recently, the California AFL-CIO, representing 2.3 million workers, passed a resolution against the blockade and to remove Cuba from the SSOT. And in LA, we are particularly concerned and interested in getting more labor support in this Let Cuba Play committee. We've already been receiving support from the Machinist Union, from the Marine Division of the Longshoremen's Union, which is the Inland Boatmen's Union, and other unions, the Amazon workers, members of Teamster Locals, and others. So big focus on labor, getting prominence to support this campaign. Our big effort will be to get athletes, sports writers to write about this, because ultimately we want a resolution passed by the LA City Council, endorsed by Mayor Karen Bass, to demand that Cubans be granted visas to come to LA and participate in the games.
Hmm. Well, what is your status, or what is the status of delegations? Because I know you, Mark, have led a youth activist delegations to Cuba. What's the status on travel from the U.S. to Cuba?
Under the Trump administration, they've instituted, and also these existed under Biden, licenses, 12 particular categories of licenses by which you can travel legally to Cuba. Journalist, religious, freedom, educational, support for the Cuban people. So the delegations that we have taken of labor and youth activists, and Hakeem and Destiny went for their first time this year, and we'll be heading up our delegation again in May of this year. It is composed of people who are activists. It included a delegation of members of About Face, who are U.S. war veterans from the Afghanistan and Iraqi wars, who are against U.S. policies on Cuba, who are for the ending of the U.S. control of the base in Guantanamo. They themselves have been used against the people of L.A. with these illegal ICE raids in Los Angeles. So the about-face participation in our delegation is very important. That is separate and apart from this Let Cuba Play campaign. And we welcome people to contact us also if they're interested in going to Cuba with us this May.
Yes, and please give that information as well where they can contact you.
So that would be to la.us.handsoffcuba@gmail.com. And for the information on the Let Cuba Play, especially if you know any athletes, sports teams that would be willing to come in on this, sports writers from campus newspapers or radio or whatever, please contact us at letcubaplay@gmail.com.
Well, I have a question, a follow-up question to Hakeem and Destiny. Maybe Hakeem first. It's the same question. As, you know, being youth organizers, activists, can you tell us how you maintain courage right now in an atmosphere where immigrants are under increased risk and other people who don't agree with the current administration are under risk? Do you feel afraid, or what is your message to listeners who might be afraid to speak out publicly, even as we're doing right now? Hakeem, how about you first?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, you could definitely be afraid, but never stop fighting. And every time I go to Cuba and I see the alternative that they really represent to the world, I mean, just the way that they organize their whole life. And every time I go there, I'm just so inspired, and it continues to motivate me, despite, you know, the tremendous difficulties and challenges and oppression that we have here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Destiny, how about you?
For me, what came to mind was the histories that I have learned under dictatorships, genocides, oppressive regimes, just histories of very drastic loss. I studied in Argentina for an entire semester, and part of my learning was learning about the dictatorship. That was only about 50 years recent, and I didn't know that. I was completely disconnected from the history of Argentina, and I visited a couple of museums as a young teenager. I visited the Museum of Tolerance to learn about the Holocaust. I think being in conversation, being in spaces, learning about these discourses, these histories, are super vital to humanizing myself, but also recognizing where they're the sayings of never again, should this ever happen again. And what I've noticed is our silence, if we choose to be silent, if we choose to hide, if we are not aware in the ways in which history repeats itself, and we're not able to at least identify patterns, then we become blind to these issues. We become blind to the overtaking of not necessarily just fascism, but even if we simplify it, of evil, of isolation, alienation, of belittling others. It's through engaging in these histories, dark as they may be. Even as a teenager, being at the Museum of Tolerance, it's not necessarily a Knott's Berry Farm trip. Like, I'm not at a festival. I'm not at a roller coaster area. I could have been doing that. But by being a part of these spaces and learning about these histories and the stories that exist, but also the way in which organizers were able to combat that, you learn about the mothers in Argentina who would come together in the Plaza de Mayo. And in that area, they would just unify asking where their children were, because there were hundreds of disappeared young people, activists, scholars, professors, and even those who were not activists, but community members who spoke ill of the regime, the fascist regime. And forgive me, I don't remember it at this moment. Their solidarity with one another, their bravery and courage, despite being brutalized by police and other forms of military, because it was a military dictatorship, that form of unity, to learn of that gives me courage to know that this is not an isolated event, and there are places that I can go to seek wisdom and knowledge and hear stories. That is exactly where I pull my courage from. And I encourage everybody to start to explore beyond the histories that we've learned in our basic education system in the United States, because they're heavily censored and they're not true. At least if there is truth, there is a very minimal truth that of what we're learning. So I highly encourage everyone to start learning about those histories, the dark histories in our not only our nation, but in around the world, so we may understand how we can combat these things.
Ah, well, thank you so much. It is time to wrap, but I wanted to thank all of you, Norman Solomon, my first guest, and then Destiny Rivera, Hakeem Jihad, and Mark Friedman, all with the Let Cuba Play Committee, as well as Board Op, Ozzy Flamenco, and everyone at KPFK. Until next week, stand up for your rights.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
Hi, I'm Ashley Judd, and I believe that when we listen collectively, change happens. And I believe we should listen to girls and women. I believe that girls and women